Well, this is the second radio broadcast we're doing here from the ICMC. This is maybe a bit of a weird show we're doing today because we had a computer crash yesterday, basically on Tuesday, and we lost the first 10 minutes of the show. So you might hear a bit later in the discussion some breaks or some connection between two parts of the show. It's basically because we had to redo the recording now of the two first participants of that show, which is called Immersed Music, which is also the topic of the ICMC. On the talk we have on the panel, we had Barbara Tillman and Steve Mann yesterday that will speak later in the presentation. And we have now on the table Christopher Jensen and Gary Kendall that both will tell us a bit like what they hear about immersed music or what they think about immersed music. Christopher is also the chair of the conference, so he's one of the people that selected this topic, aren't you?
That is correct, yes. So when I decided to organize ICMC 2007, I decided on taking advantage of the waterfront of Copenhagen, and I found the School of Architecture as a very nice place to organize ICMC. So at that moment, I decided with discussions and after some thoughts on the topic immersed music. The reason for this topic was primarily because I think a lot of people, me including, understand a lot about psychoacoustics in computer music and how the ear is influential in, for instance, hearing dissonance and consonance. But all of the interpretation and cognitive aspects of music we don't know very much about. Therefore, immersed music is a theme that should invite people from the neuroscience and the cognitive research communities.
So this cognitive aspect we will hear in the part we recorded yesterday with Barbara Tillman, and we should maybe go more now with Gary Kendall to this really physical aspect, because you've been speaking or you spoke about this relationship we have with space and the immersion of our body into music. Maybe we could trace also a bit of history with the...
Mm-hmm. So when I heard the conference's theme, the first thing I related it to was, you know, parts of my work and parts of my creativity that I most focus on, which is the experience that people have being immersed in sound. And the idea of people being immersed in sound has a long history. Part of that sense of immersion often comes when people are in spaces that have a lot of reverberation. For instance, when people are in something like an old cathedral, and they have this feeling when they walk into the space that there's something special about the space. You know, there's something special about the experience of having that sound come from all around you. And it turns out that there's a particular psychoacoustic effect that those kinds of spaces create in people, something that's called envelopment, the sensation of being enveloped in sound. Well, interesting historically, you know, of course, people have been making rooms and buildings, you know, what's out of stone for a very long time. And there's a social history about sound immersion. And part of this history is that people find that when they're in those kinds of spaces very often, that there's this invisible quality, the sound immersion that's in those spaces. And it's been associated with sacred traditions and sacred spaces. So it's not unusual, for instance, that we have that sense of sound immersion in a cathedral. And in fact, the other place that we often experience where we have that same sense of sound immersion is in a concert hall, which I think is part of an explanation for why people often think of concert halls as something akin to a sacred space. You know, we walk into the concert hall, we get quiet, and we expect something extraordinary and special to happen for us there.
And to trace that with the actual position or with the technology today, I feel like you spoke, or we had a discussion quickly about stereo and surround, and somehow those spaces, they were natural acoustics, or they were meant for that. And I have the feeling that technology at one point is becoming now like a prosthetic or some artifact of the space.
Well, the interesting thing is, of course, given the inspiration of how musical spaces have worked in the past, now we use technology to expand the capacity so that we can create that sense of immersion in other kinds of spaces, spaces that are created basically through loudspeakers and electronic transducers. So this wasn't something that was particularly easy to do with stereo sound. Obviously, stereo sound brought a lot of capacities to people that worked very well, but it is something that works very well when people have headphones. So for instance, when people are listening to music with their iPod systems and they, you know, they have the sound speakers inside of each ear, they can very often experience that sense of immersion of a space that's around them and it's enveloping them. But that's not something that's very easy to do when you have a group of people. And very often for the kind of art that we do at conferences like this one, when we're talking about music that's created with technology, electroacoustic music, you know, we want to have a group experience. So you know, the convention is, and the development of the science is, to go beyond two speakers, to go to eight speakers or more. And there's a parallel development that happens in the realm of sound for movies and movie theaters, because movies used to be essentially one-channel sound, and now, of course, we have five-channel sound. And those systems that are designed for the movie theaters today are specifically designed so that the people in the audience can experience sound immersion. And the people in the movie industry are very intelligent about this. Of course, they read the research, too. And they want that. They want that sense that the sound reaches out and surrounds the people who are watching the movie.
Okay, thank you. I think this relationship or this immersion with the physical experience or with the body or also with what happens in the brain once we are immersed with sound could be one of the good introduction to the work of Barbara Tillman, which is also sitting here, and that maybe can explain us where or what she's dealing with.
The connection that I can make with the theme of the conference, immersed music, is that I would say that we are all immersed in music almost all the time in everyday life, being exposed to musical systems. And what I'm interested in as a cognitive scientist or cognitive neuroscientist is how is the brain processing sound, and more particularly, how is the brain processing music. And so part of my research is interested in how, most particularly, someone who never learned an instrument or never had classes of music theory, so a non-musician listener, how is he or she processing musical structures thanks to this immersion to musical pieces in everyday life. So the idea is that the brain has the capacity to become sensitive to regularities and structures that exist in sounds in our environment, to build up like a knowledge database that then influences perception. And I'm focusing on the music perception side, obviously.
That's what you expressed this morning with the implicit learning, no? You use that expression.
Exactly. There's the capacity of the brain that we call implicit learning, which means that just by mere exposure to structured systems or regularities, the brain picks up these regularities, becomes sensitive to these to build up knowledge that then allows in specific situations to develop expectations to better interact with the most probably occurring events that fits the best with the structures, just to have a better interaction. And so implicit learning is at the basis of when we think of learning of the mother tongue by an infant, picking up regularities of the language and then having linguistic knowledge of the mother tongue. And the same kind of learning mechanisms apply when we talk about non-musician listeners building up knowledge about musical systems.
Okay. You had a keynote yesterday in the ICMC, which was pretty successful. And I think it's also interesting to think that you're not coming from the field of music computer, or you're not dealing with that as a subject. I mean, your subject is really the brain study or the psychological aspect of study. And I would like to know, I mean, it really sounded like a lot of the people here taking part of the ICMC came to you and had this kind of response or those kind of questions to your research. Do you know why, or could you tell us a bit what was behind these questions?
But when I was preparing the keynote, I was going through the pre-program that Christopher sent me, and I tried to pick out concepts or terminology that might construct an overlap between the interest of cognitive science or cognitive neuroscience and the ICMC community, like concepts like learning, representation, key finding, algorithm tools, rhythm, meter, and particularly expectations. So I tried to construct the presentation around these topics, but from the side of cognitive science, presenting also about the questioning, what is the brain doing, and also how can we investigate the brain, the knowledge behind, what kind of methodologies can we use to answer the questions that we might have. It was interesting to hear then afterwards the feedback that people said, well, we are working on the same concept, but from different perspectives, and perhaps that's the goal, to try to find an overlap and grasp it from different point of views, made that people came then and discussed different ideas or different concepts or different approaches that then might allow for combination between the computer or the modeling side that we also use in cognitive science, but for the perspective to model the brain and not for the from the perspective to model a musical system or create a new compositional system.
Christopher, would you react to that? Because, I mean, as you said, really this cognition aspect or this question of perception of music was, I mean, one of the subtexts of the immersed music program or the immersed music topic.
Yes. So, I'm happy to see Barbara Tillman here at ICMC, and I think we have a lot of things in common. And I think that the neuroscience and cognitive research will give us answers to some things that we do not yet know. In particular, I'm interested in how musicians get, how they communicate and are maybe immersed in music producing together, and how the communication takes place between them to improve performance and learn new performances. And I think that there are some cognitive aspects of this that could be very interesting, perhaps from Barbara Tillman.
Okay, thank you. Maybe we could now shift to the second understanding we have of this expression, immersed music, with Steve Mann, which is both, I think, your inventor, composer. You've been conceiving new musical instruments that mostly deal with water or underwater systems. And maybe we could explain us a bit your relationship now with immersed music.
Sure. I guess I've invented a number of immersed instruments. And so to understand these in context, we traditionally think of the orchestra as having three sections, strings, percussion, and wind. But strings and percussion, a piano is both string and a percussion. So those aren't really top-level descriptors organologically. So I think of solid instruments that make sound from solid matter. String is sort of one-dimensional solid, and a membranophone is two-dimensional solid, idiophone is three-dimensional solid, and then aerophone is gas. And when I started to think organologically in terms of solid and gas, I said, well, hey, wait a minute, there's three states of matter, you know, solid, liquid, and gas. So in terms of the initial sound production, I invented a number of new instruments that use liquid as the initial sound-producing medium. And these instruments run on they need to be immersed in water in order to work. And they can work, they play best underwater, immersed totally in water, with the listener also immersed in water. But for practical reasons and some of the issues that Christoph mentioned too is that musicians communicate and so on. There's a lot of problems in performing underwater. So we did a number of we used to do weekly underwater concerts in the pool. And there's often problems of communicating. So then I designed the instruments so that they could be played above the water. So what I did is had the instruments filled with water, and then I came up with some mechanism to make them audible outside the water. So they're loud enough. If the instrument's loud enough and strong enough, you can actually hear it when you're not in the water.
But once you speak about first the first tries you did, even the audience was underwater, so the ears were immersed in water.
Yeah, some of the early instruments that I built, you actually had to be underwater in order to hear them.
So that's kind of something I would like to hear you. We were speaking about cathedral. What will that mean somehow to be in such a space? I mean, if we consider that now we put our ears in water.
Well, and you consider that human beings spend so much time in water, and there's lots of evolutionary biologists who say that we spent more time in water evolutionarily than we imagine. I mean, one of the big differences with sound transmission in water is that sound moves much more quickly, but it also breaks up in ways that are different from the way it breaks up in the air. So it creates a new sonic world, I think. You know, a world that we have historical and personal connection to, you know, a world that hasn't been explored in terms of its auditory possibilities, in terms of the aesthetic possibilities. So I think Steve's work is very exciting that way.
And, yeah, Christopher?
Yeah, I'm very happy to see Steve's approach, because when I decided on the theme immersed music, I was having dreams about having performers underwater and trying to transmit the sound from the water to people outside the water. And I was having ideas about having people in the water and trying to transmit sound from the air to the water. And these are difficult problems, as Gary Kendall mentions, but I never had in my mind the idea that the performer, the instrument, and the audience would be all underwater, which I think is a very nice, homogeneous approach to the theme immersed music.
And so going back now to your actual instruments, maybe you could tell us a bit more. You spoke yesterday that it's almost working like a flute. You have this outside, I mean, now you're not playing underwater anymore, but you really designed object that can be played, I mean, close from any water source. And you really told me, or could you tell us a bit how it's working or how it's going to sound also?
Yes, modern hydraulophones can be played underwater or above the water. And so the sonic experience is definitely different underwater. Last night when we were rehearsing for tonight's concert, we had some musicians underwater and some above the water. And there's this issue of communication between the underwater musicians and the above water musicians, and problems with feedback and everything. And so typically we have the underwater musicians wearing headphones so they can hear the above water instruments and so on, and the underwater hydrophones underwater so that the people up above the water can hear underwater. And so the instrument itself, the hydraulophone, is like a flute. It looks like a flute. It looks like a giant flute, and it's a big pipe with holes in it. And a concert hydraulophone, you know, typically has 45 finger holes in it. It's like a giant flute. And a park hydraulophone, we install these in public parks at landmark architecture sites and that sort of thing. And those versions look like a fountain. You know, there's some of them have big organ pipes that are filled with water. And so the instruments fill up with water from a pump. And they work similar to a flute. However, one important difference is that with a regular flute, you blow into the mouthpiece, and then you put your fingers over the finger holes. But humans don't breathe water, so the flute needs to get its supply of water not from the mouth of the player, but you have a pump that you pump it by hand. You might pump with your left hand and play with your right hand, or you can pedal the pump. You know, so you can have a pedal-powered pump that's like a bicycle while you're playing, or you can have an electric pump. Usually, sometimes I play one or two songs with a hand-operated pump just to convince that it's a real instrument that doesn't use electricity. And then once you have an electric pump or a garden hose, a source of pressurized water, in Greek and Roman times, you would have built an aqueduct really high with a long pipe coming down to get the pressure. And so the water has to be under fairly high pressure and goes into the instrument. And because there's no mouthpiece explicitly, the holes are actually the mouthpiece, so the finger holes are the mouthpieces. And whereas with a regular flute, you get your embouchure or expression by adjusting the shape of your mouth, with this flute, you get your expression by inserting your fingers into the flute's mouths. And sometimes people call these Nessies because they look like the Loch Ness Monster in the sea, you know, when they're underwater. These underwater instruments, they look like pipes underwater. People are always reminded of the Loch Ness Monster in Scotland. So people call these Nessies, and they say that they refer to the instrument as a she, I guess because the Loch Ness Monster. And so, you know, she has 45 finger holes, 45 mouths. So we talk of these holes that is mouths, and you put your fingers into the mouths. And because the instrument has more than one mouth, you can play more than one note at the same time. You can play chords by putting your finger into more than one mouth at the same time. Each mouth has a fipple-like mechanism. Like a regular flute only has one fipple or sharp edge and then a bunch of finger holes. A hydraulophone, by necessity, because humans don't breathe water, must have the fipple mechanisms in the mouths of the instrument, not the one master mouth where the pump is hooked up. Otherwise, the instrument would continue to sound even when you took your fingers away.
I've seen some photos with kids playing your instrument, so it doesn't ask some specific knowledge about like being a musician to play them, or they are quite simple instruments somehow to interpret or to play.
Well, there's different kinds of hydraulophones. There's what we call concert hydraulophones, which are for concert halls. So this one is for playing with an orchestra. You know, this is a symphony orchestra, and it has a water section. So these hydraulophones are for being played by skilled hydraulists. And then we make other hydraulophones that we install permanently in public parks as outdoor fixtures that run 24 hours a day. So one, for example, this one hydraulophone we have here is installed, is the main centerpiece, the main architectural centerpiece at a landmark architecture site in Canada. And it runs 24 hours a day because it's their main fountain out in front of the building. And so anybody can come over and play it, any members of the public. And that hydraulophone appeals to a wide variety of people. Like, a lot of times composers come out there. During the day, there's a lot of children playing on it. But a lot of composers come out at night when there's not too many people. So at 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, you'll often see somebody there composing music for it, undisturbed, you know, when there's not too many people around. So it has a wide range of appeal. Because of the expression, you can play microtonally, and you can change the timbre and everything by the way that you squeeze the water jets. So it's a cross between a flute and an organ. It's kind of like a keyboard instrument would be, that you can play polyphonically, but you can also independently adjust the timbre and the microtonality of each of the notes. So you can play a chord, you know, a 10-finger chord, and then you can choose to change and make one element of that chord droop down in a sad sort of way and leave all 9 other notes sounding the same.
And you're speaking about flutes. How does it sound like? I mean, will that be somebody or something that people will recognize? I mean, we will speak up after about that with Barbara, maybe, about recognizing sound. Or, I mean, what is exactly what? How does that sound?
Well, it's interesting because when I hear a hydraulophone, I recognize it right away. But the sound of a hydraulophone is so diverse; it can produce such a wide range of different sounds, much more so than a flute, because the water has more density and more force, so it allows it to, and because of the density of the water as a medium, you can squeeze it in so many different ways to sound like a huge variety of different sounds. So it can sound like anything from somebody sneezing. You can make it sound like somebody sneezing. You can make it sound like a very pure, steady tone. The most characteristic sound of it, I think, is the dynamics. I mean, there's a way that hydraulists normally play it. So there's a wide range of sounds. So when children play on this instrument or whatever, it can have a big range of sounds. But when a skilled hydraulist, there's a certain style that's evolved. And that particular style is a very sad and sweet kind of sound that sounds kind of like the lonesome call of a loon in the wilderness. The notes, you tend to microtonally play. You're playing in just intonation in A minor, and then you change keys into some other key. You can still stay in just intonation by the way that you manipulate your fingers. And then, so one of the things is the intonation evolves and walks as you change keys, which no other instrument has that property. And the other sort of unique property is this very wonderfully sad and sweet kind of sound as you pull back on the jets and come from the center of the... Sounds a lot different if you put your finger down the center of the mouth. If you come over to the edge, it sort of droops down in a really sad, lonesome kind of sound that is is quite typical of how people often play the instrument.
Okay, thank you. Maybe now it's a weird question from me, or weird shift in the discussion, but I think we have here So with Steve and Barbara, two people that are working, so to say, outside of the field. I mean, you both deal with something called, let's say, the public. I mean, because Steve, you're making those installations in the public space, so people will come and play it, have a reaction with that. And also, I think, Barbara, your study, you explained me, I mean, the way you research is really not meant, like, you're dealing with people that are non-musicians, no? Or about, like, how do normal people, I mean, what is normal people anyway? But, I mean, how do people perceive sound or perceive music? Could you maybe speak a bit more about that, this relationship you have with the normal listeners, or what do you learn from the non-listeners?
With the research we are doing, we try to understand how the, what you call normal people, or I guess what's the...
Non-listeners, maybe that was the best non-musician thing.
Non-musician listener, just the idea of the general audience, that the majority of people have no explicit knowledge of music theory, of playing an instrument, or... went to a conservatory or something like this. So that's the what we define as the non-musician listener. What I mentioned earlier is the idea that the non-musician listener has knowledge about the musical system, so we actually can call him, he's like an expert of music perception, but on an implicit level. Implicit level in the sense that these listeners cannot verbalize or explain what they perceive or what musical structures they are actually following when listening to a musical piece. And so the thing of our research is, or the trick is, find adequate methodology to actually have an insight into their brains and how they process the musical structures. So what is the knowledge I was talking about? How does it influence perception? And not necessarily asking them directly and interviewing them. So how do you perceive this? Or does this sound fine? But rather find other methods to investigate music perception without directly asking them, like in an interview. And so the contact we have is, well, we try to understand how the non-musician brain is processing music. So we invite people into the laboratory and test them, in the sense that we present them musical excerpts that we manipulate in a specific way and ask them to do specific experimental tasks, pressing buttons in a specific way. So we need the people to actually advance our understanding of how the brain processes music.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you. And you wanted to say something.
Yeah, you know, in listening to the conversation we've had, one of the things that occurs to me that's, you know, in a moment of reflection, we stop and we look at what we're doing. You know, it seems that... part of what's always unclear to us is exactly where we are in evolution. We're specifically, you know, very often unclear where we are in the evolution of technology. But we're talking here today about knowledge that's implemented through technology that reaches out to all people, to non-experts. And we're also talking about a relationship with water. And, you know, and people don't normally associate water with technology, but in fact, it seems that part of the world that we're creating now and we're beginning to inhabit now, is one where technology takes on a different role and it touches the life of human beings in a different way. The fact that Steve's instruments are ones that you touch and you touch the water. You know, this is transcending the usual barriers that we think of that people have with technology, or the fact that Barbara's work is reaching out to all of these people. I mean, I think what happens is that our work is no longer about technology. It's really about the human being. And where we're talking about a relationship with water, particularly for, you know, one of the themes of this conference, it seems to me one of the really important things is that, you know, all the water that's on the earth is all the water that's ever been here. And we have a sort of a responsibility about relationship to water, for instance. And I think there's a water consciousness that often is associated with cities that have a close relationship with water, like this city does. And that, you know, the art isn't merely about the technical, but it's also about connecting to ourselves and our lives. So the water connection, it seems to me, is another area where people have implicit knowledge. they have some implicit knowledge of their own relationship with water. And with Steve's instruments, when he's talking about solid, liquid, gas, you know, and plasma instruments, you know, people, I think, have an intuitive connection with those kinds of ideas, with states of being that are associated with the world around them. And so our technology today and the technology we're developing here, you know, transcends that kind of technology that was locked up in a room, and now it becomes ubiquitous and infused into everyone's life. But for artistic purposes, infused into everyone's life in ways that ought to be tapping this implicit knowledge and bringing meaning to the experience, meaning that helps us to be in touch with the world that we're in today.
So maybe, Christopher, now you could introduce, I mean, if you want to say anything more about like a kind of conclusion on the discussion we had on this topic of immersed music or going back to the ICMC, and if not, maybe introducing the track you will play. I think we will play the tracks in that order. We will play yours, then Steve's, then Gary. And so if each of you could tell us a bit like what we will hear, in which context the piece was produced, or what it's meant for, and in which direction it's going. But maybe you want first to make some kind of conclusion to the discussion, Christopher.
I think I will give an anecdote of the ICMC because of the theme immersed music. I commissioned a composer, Birgitte Alsted, to make a music sonification of a statue, an immersed statue, which is called Agnete og Havmanden, Agnete and the Man from the Sea, which is in the center of Copenhagen. So this statue is immersed. I thought that was a good relationship with the theme of the conference. Me and Birgitte Alsted, we went there to see the statue, and we discovered it was missing, it was gone. And that was a blow to the project, but we decided to go on, and we contacted the sculptor, Suste Bonin, and she contacted the city of Copenhagen in order to make arrangement for the reinstallation of the statue. And finally, the city of Copenhagen bought the statue, and they now, since 4 days, have reinstalled it in the original space. And we have had the music composition, the sonification, running for a few days, and we're very happy with it. And the conclusion of this experience is, for me, that computer music saves a statue, which I'm very happy with. So I would like to present my music work, which has been done in collaboration with a composer, Laurent Saxy-George. And the approach to this composition and the music texture used is the one which is commonly found in natural science of isolation. So we have the problem of what is music and what is the music material you can use. And in order to try to look into that, I decided to use as little as possible. Hence the title, Etude Blanche. And the result of this is that I try to have a mathematically wide spectrum, the same energy for all frequency, and a mathematic distribution of frequencies. So there is the same probability of having a frequencies for all the different frequencies in the audible range. Unfortunately, my research is mainly dealing with these fields, not so much with the temporal structure. So there is a temporal structure in the music consisting of the superpositions of fast textures, which I call geigers, and slow textures, which I call cymbals.
Okay, thank you. Steve, what will we hear from you?
Hi.
What will you give us as a sample?
Yeah, we'll hear a variety of different kinds of hydraulophones, just because people ask that, what does a hydraulophone sound like? And a variety of different sound textures that can be produced by hydraulophone. And we'll also hear some works of the composer Ryan Jansen, who who composes for hydraulophone, and sometimes with orchestra, symphony orchestra and hydraulophone. And so the hydraulophone is a very difficult instrument to play well. And I mean, with some strength, you can make sound on it, you know, a moderate amount of strength. I mean, even children are strong enough to make it produce sound. But to make it play really well requires a lot of background. So we'll hear the works of some works of Ryan Jansen, original compositions and performance. And he studied fluid dynamics too. He took 3 advanced courses in fluid dynamics just to understand, you know, how the water goes out through the opening and how to position his fingers, you know, to get it into different kinds of states, you know, depending on its dynamic, you know, because you block it. We'll also hear, since this is a computer music conference, we also have some hyper instruments, hyperacoustic instruments. Hyperacoustic is a new concept. I'm sure everybody's aware of the hyper instruments, you know, where you have like a sensor on a violin bow or something. A hyperacoustic instrument is where you put underwater microphones, hydrophones. If you put a hydrophone in the water and collect the sound from the instrument and run it through a computer, we designed some hydrophones that receive broadband, broader than the regular sound spectrum, to pick up the sounds of the hydraulophone makes sounds that we can't hear. It makes a lot of subsonic sounds and it makes a lot of ultrasonic sounds that can't be heard. Because of the water, it produces a very broad spectrum of sound and sound texture that's normally inaudible.
So we will hear some music that has been recorded underwater.
And yeah, we'll hear some recorded underwater music, but also we'll hear, you know, even from the concert tonight, okay, some recorded underwater music, but also hyperacoustic, where we take sounds that the instrument produces that are ultrasonic and infrasonic, and we bring those into the computer and make them and process them in different ways to make this hyperacoustic instrument.
I mean, that brings us back a bit to this question of space. I mean, what we will hear now, it's going to be stereo, and I absolutely don't know the piece you're going to play, Gary. Is that something that was meant for 8 channels, or
yeah,
is that really a stereo piece normally? So maybe you could trace us a bit, like...
Yeah, the piece that we'll be hearing, the excerpt of the piece we'll be hearing, is a piece that was designed for 8 loudspeakers surrounding an audience. And one of the elements of the sound, which is manipulated for the artistic purposes, is the spatiality and the sense of immersion. So there are times with very, you know, dense sense of immersion, and other times when it's very sparse. But of course, we will be hearing it in stereo, so you have to use your imagination a little bit to imagine what it might be like if you were in the middle of the sound. The piece itself is based upon 3 songs sung by an Amazonian shaman. As a man I had the fortunate opportunity to meet in Peru, and the people who do healing and the people who do sacred work there usually have a repertoire of songs. So there are 3 songs that are influencing the piece. You never actually hear the shaman's voice, but his music is informing everything. It's as if I was in mining his songs for data and used that in the composition. So it was another way for me bridging that gap between sort of sacred tradition or traditional sacred tradition and bringing that into the context of technology.
Okay, thank you. Of course, we will not hear any except from Barbara Tillman, because she is not making any music. Still, maybe I would like to hear from you. You could tell me what the kind of samples or music tunes you're using in your research, just to know, once you have your audience coming to you, what are they listening to exactly in your lab?
It depends on the studies or the research line. So if, for example, it's an experiment where we try to analyze what kind of tonal knowledge listeners have, then we stay on short musical tunes that are composed for the purpose of an experiment, like short little melodies following tonal regularities. melodies that end as expected because the music theory would predict it like this, or that we manipulate to have some kind of subtle, unexpected ending, and then see how listeners react on this. So that can be short chord sequences or short little melodies with also a rhythm, for example, but highly controlled. And in other experiments where we're more interested, for example, in the implicit learning question, we can our goal is to recreate like this tonal acculturation process that happens in everyday life, but in miniature inside the laboratory. So we take tones or different timbres and create new artificial sound systems following specific regularities and expose this to the people. So it's not an artistic object, it's not computer music, because the purpose is to manipulate the structural regularities and have then little sequences that follow specific regularities, either based on timbre or on tones.
Okay, thanks a lot. I think now we can listen to the music part of this radio broadcast. Sorry, I'm not speaking well. And yeah, Christopher, Gary, Barbara, and Steve, it was a pleasure to have you here, and maybe we see you at the concert tonight also, Steve.
Yes, that'll be great.
Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.